if you want to avoid all the sickness this winter, the snotty noses, the coughs, the colds, the sleepless nights, the fevers, the Panadol and the antibiotics, the ear infections, the grumpy, tired kids, the days off work and school and childcare, are all those memories of last winter coming back? I'm here to tell you that it doesn't have to be that way this winter. I have a free online masterclass, 3 simple ways to boost your kids' immunity to avoid a winter full of sickness. It's on demand, meaning you can register and watch it straight away or watch it at a time that is convenient for you. Head on over to naturalsuperkids.com/immune and you will be able to sign up. In the masterclass, I am covering our natural, simple, and effective approach to avoiding winter infections, how to boost your family's immunity with our proven 3-step naturopathic strategy that is really easy for you to implement as a busy mum. We're going to talk about the immune depleters that you need to avoid so you're not wasting time and money building up your kids' immunity that is just being depleted by these common foods and environmental factors. I am sharing heaps of practical tips. I promise it will be an hour well spent. You can register again at naturalsuperkids.com/immune. I can't wait to hear how you find it and to give you the tips to make this winter healthier. Welcome to the Natural Super Kids podcast, where you will discover practical strategies to inspire you to boost the health and nutrition of your kids. I'm Jessica Donovan, a qualified naturopath specializing in kids' health, and I want to make it as easy as possible for you to raise healthy and happy kids. Let's get into it. Hello and welcome back to the Natural Super Kids podcast. Jessica Donovan here. Today I have a very special guest joining me. I'm really excited to share this conversation, and next week's conversation is going to be a follow-on to this one. I'll get to that in a second. But today we have Dr. Steve Hodges, all the way from North Carolina, joining me. So Steve is a pediatric urologist, and today we are talking about the very common issues that we see in kids, encopresis and enuresis, which is basically wetting and pooping accidents in kids, as well as bedwetting, which is known as nocturnal enuresis. So I have brought Steve on to talk about his unique approach to addressing the root cause of these issues with his MOP protocol. And MOP stands for the Modified O'Regan Protocol. So the protocol was initially kind of developed by Sean O'Regan, and Dr. Steve Hodges has modified the protocol and has really great success in, you know, treating the root cause of bedwetting and, let's just call them, weeing and pooping accidents in kids. So Dr. Steve Hodges is a professor of pediatric urology at Wake Forest University School of Medicine. He's a leading authority on childhood toileting issues. He's dedicated to debunking common myths surrounding enuresis, bedtime and daytime wetting, and encopresis, pooping accidents, emphasizing that these issues are never a child's fault. Dr. Hodges resides in Winston-Salem, North Carolina with his family. He's authored 8 books for both parents and children, and we're talking about the concepts and protocols in these books. And I love that he not only has a very comprehensive book about, you know, what exactly is going on and underlying these issues in kids, but also books to share with children that are having these issues. Because, as you know, if you're a parent, of a child that is having toileting accidents or bedwetting, particularly as they get older, you know, there can be a lot of shame and a lot of guilt and a lot of embarrassment around these issues. So not only does he share information for parents and professionals, but he also shares information for kids in his ebooks as well. And he has an amazing website with a lot of great information. It is bedwettingandaccidents.com, and that's where you'll find links to all of his resources and services as well. We'll make sure those links are in the show notes. So I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Steve Hodges. Oh, but before we get stuck into today's conversation with Dr. Steve Hodges, I do just want to give you a bit of a spoiler alert as to, you know, what his research kind of points out as the key underlying cause of toileting accidents and bedwetting in kids, which is constipation. And so, you know, I just wanted to make you aware of that as we go into the conversation. And it's really interesting that he talks about, you know, not only obvious constipation, which we have definitely seen a link in here at Natural Super Kids, you know, as we address and resolve constipation in kids, often the bedwetting and the toileting accidents, you know, are resolved as well. But he actually shares what I was really shocked at, this stat, that probably only about 5% of the patients that he works with have obvious constipation. And sometimes it takes a lot of kind of, you know, sharing information and sharing proof, like in terms of x-rays and things, to get parents on board that their kids actually do have constipation issues. But he's got a lot of really great information in his book about, you know, some of the, I guess, red flags that aren't always obvious when it comes to kids and constipation. And he talks quite often about a laxative called Miralax, which is a US laxative. The alternative or the equivalent to that here in Australia is Movicol. And, you know, he's talking about osmotic laxatives. And, you know, so Osmolax, Movicol, and Coloxyl are all examples of osmotic laxatives that you can get here in Australia. I am also going to have a episode next week. I'm going to follow this episode on with another episode next week, just with me talking about our approach to bedwetting, you know, including resolving constipation, but also some other things you might want to consider when you're looking at, you know, bedwetting, particularly in kids. Okay, here's Dr. Steve. Welcome to the Natural Super Kids podcast, Dr. Steve Hodges.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's so great to have you here, and I'm excited to dive into this topic with you. So can you just start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you came to be a specialist in this field?
Yes, I'm a pediatric urologist by training, which is a primarily surgical subspecialty, dealing with the urinary tract in children, the congenital anomalies mostly of the kidneys, ureters, bladder, and then some other genitalia. But about half our practice in reality is based on what people might call, used to call, voiding dysfunction. Then it was called dysfunctional elimination. Now it's called bowel and bladder dysfunction, but basically kids with problems peeing and pooping. Peeing primarily from our perspective, UTIs, accidents, and so forth. But because we make a living doing surgery, a lot of the folks here don't see these kids themselves. They kind of get sent off to either physician assistants or nurse practitioners. We have physician extenders here that kind of help see patients if you're busy. And they will do a cookbook treatment for these problems. And that's been standardized over the past 10, 20 years. So when I started, I was seeing them myself just because we didn't have those people. And I was using that cookbook protocol and not getting good results. And that led to my research, which led to my findings and what we're going to talk about today.
Awesome. Okay. And so I love that you simplify it and just keep calling it peeing and pooping accidents.
Yeah. It's too hard to say the other words, honestly.
Yeah, I know. And I was actually practicing the pronunciations, if I'm honest, before we hopped on. Because the technical terms are enuresis and encorpresis. Enuresis being the peeing accidents and encorpresis being the pooping accidents. So can you explain a little bit about the differences or the key differences in these challenges?
So basically, when you have enuresis, and the terminology always changes. So it's probably better not even to learn the terminology because it changes every few years. They have a meeting and they change it. It used to be, my favorite terminology was nocturnal enuresis, which is peeing on yourself when you don't know it at night. Diurnal enuresis, which is while awake. And I know you're not always awake during the day or sleep at night, but you know what I mean. And then encopresis means poop accidents that you can't feel. And so this is involuntary loss of urine or poop. And so that's the important thing to know, because a lot of these kids will get blamed. Like, why didn't you go to the bathroom? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you go in time? And the reality is, although children do withhold a bit, the accidents happen like a reflex. Like if I were to hit your knee with a reflex hammer and ask you why you kicked your leg, you'd be like, I didn't mean to. And same thing with these accidents. They happen as a reflex. And they don't feel it. And that's actually one of the main signs of the condition. And a lot of parents complain to me like, I said, you're wet, and they didn't even know it, and they get all these thoughts in their head that there might be something more going on with their child when it's actually pretty simple.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. And I think these issues are not often kind of publicly talked about. And I think, people, I mean, we see it a lot here at Natural Super Kids. I mean, we deal a lot with kids with, gut issues, digestive symptoms. And I know we're going to be talking a bit about this. Kids, we see it commonly in kids that are on the spectrum as well. And so can you talk a little bit more about like how common bedwetting and, daytime wetting accidents are in children?
Yeah, to your point, the all these conditions are much more common in children with autism or even ADHD. So
yes,
neurodivergent or however you want to call it, kids that aren't maybe typically developmentally will have these issues more. And we can explain that, I think, but just it's good for parents to know that. But basically, for the kids that have accidents, sorry, I lost my track of thought. Your original question was, your ultimate question was,
How common is bedwetting and toileting accidents in kids? Yeah.
So the stats I use is 25% of kids, about a quarter of them at the age of 5, have incontinence. Most of those kids are bedwetters. And then about 10 to 15% get better a year. So although most kids outgrow it, it is not something you can really hang your hat on. It's like waiting. We won't like pediatricians to recommend waiting just because you don't know if it's going to be in the first year or in the 10th year. And that those 10 years can be a really significant burden to these kids. And so we recommend at the age of 5 or even earlier sometimes, if you see this as a problem, to be aggressive with treatment. Mm. And it is very common.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, thank you. Thanks for sharing that. And what are some of the misconceptions, the common misconceptions about, peeing accidents and pooping accidents?
I think that primarily that the child is volitionally doing it or just it's a behavioral phase. Kids will often, it's tough. I'm not saying it's easy for parents because it's frustrating when kids either have to pee every 5 minutes or wet the bed every night and you have to wash the sheets or poop on themselves when the bathroom was right next to there. But it's better to take a step back and try to understand what's causing this. And while there may be behavioral issues in terms of just delaying pooping and peeing early on that set up for the accidents, once the accidents are happening, the kids can't control it. So thinking that it's the child's fault is a very significant kind of myth we're trying to avoid because it can lead to misunderstandings and even abuse, especially in the United States, where we kind of follow that news. And it's even one kid for that to happen to is too many. Two is that, they'll outgrow it. I mean, in reality, yes, they'll outgrow it. But if you wait, you're waiting a long time for something that can be treated a lot more quickly. So I don't believe in waiting it out. Although I can't argue against the fact that as you get older, these problems are less likely to be occurring. But I also think you can actually treat the root cause much earlier than most kids would outgrow it on their own. And all those things go along with that, that it's a phase, that they'll be dry when they want to be dry, that they have to feel it so they'll want to be dry. So they'll put kids in like underwear at night to make them feel the wetness, or make them change their sheets, so that all these kind of punishment-based teachings that are, that tie into my first two myths of them doing it volitionally or them kind of being in a phase or wanting to do it, they don't really help. And I almost take it so far sometimes just to don't encourage rewards, even because I don't want to imply that they're controlling it. Although, I mean, if a kid does a good thing, I hate to not reward them. But you follow my logic there. I want to say, you know, this is your body. It's kind of doing this on its own because of this condition you have. And if we fix it, you'll be fine. And that's the main message.
Yeah, such an important point. And so you've kind of referred to like addressing the root cause a couple of times. Can you share a bit more about what that, you know, commonly looks like based on the research that you've done?
Yeah, so I'll set up the background by saying that there's two ways people pee, right? So there's the infant reflex, which is how babies pee, right? You know, when you have your baby, 6-month-old, year old, you may be changing their diaper and they'll wet and they didn't even know they were peeing, right? They're staring at the mobile or whatever and they're just oblivious to it. It is a reflex, and that's how babies pee. And then when you potty train, you gain volitional control over your voiding, which is a kind of the adult pattern. And that's what we all know as, okay, I feel like I have to pee, and then the urge gets a little stronger and eventually I go because I don't want to feel that way anymore. And the same thing happens with pooping. The loss of the reflex void and the initiation of the adult void is not just like an on-off switch. It's not like you lose one completely and then you gain the other one completely. The infant reflex kind of dissipates as you potty train, and then once you start going on your own, you can do that. But the infant reflex can persist, and that is basically anytime you have a kid, child voiding and they didn't know they voided or they didn't feel it, it's that reflex.
Right.
And I really believe that because I talk to a lot of parents. I say, you know, go home and hold your pee till you have an accident, right? For otherwise healthy people, they cannot do that, right? Because your body will make you go pee. It's like saying, go home and don't eat till I tell you, or don't sleep till I tell you. You can't will yourself to not do those things. And so when these kids hold their urine, they may hold it a little bit longer maybe than they should have, but not as much as you think. And then when it gets to a certain point, it will shoot off a reflex void. And then they wet themselves. And what causes that involuntary void is a combination of waiting, but mostly is that they've delayed pooping a long time. They've stretched out their rectum, and the stretching of the rectum or the end of the colon in the pelvis has overstimulated the pelvic nerves. So they're kind of at an increased level of awareness that are just like overstimulated, and they're just ready to pop off at any moment. And small behavioral changes, position changes, holding your pee a little too long, laughing can set them off and cause a reflex. So if you can treat this original cause, which is actually delaying of the poop, mostly in kids that don't even show any signs of delayed pooping, you know, most parents are oblivious to it. If you can diagnose that and treat that, the accidents will go away. And those bladder accidents are tied into pooping, but also the poop accidents, obviously, if you hold poop too long, it builds up and builds up and builds up. Eventually poop will start falling out and you won't even know it. And that's what we call encopresis. So there's a typical pattern of how this problem develops as you get more backed up with poop. Typically, bedwetting will start first, which is why it seems is so common. Then daytime wetting will happen second as you get more dilated. And then poop accidents or encopresis will happen last as you get terminally dilated. But not all kids present that way. Some kids present a little differently, but that's kind of the general pattern we see in our clinic.
Yeah, that's really interesting, that kind of, you know, that pathway.
Progression, yeah.
Yeah, and progression. And, you know, as I said, we deal a lot with digestive gut issues in kids, and, you know, constipation is so common. And we have often sort of noticed this this pattern where kids, you know, when we get on top of the constipation, when it's obvious constipation, then, you know, bedwetting can really reduce and you know, stop. And so, but what you're saying is the, you know, the pooping issue of like holding on to the poop for too long isn't always obvious. So that's really interesting too.
Yeah, I would say maybe 5% of the families come in knowing the child's constipated. The rest think they're pooping very well. And little bit of a touchy subject as a doctor, because, you know, it doesn't make sense, you know, at first glance. And so, yeah, I get a lot of x-rays to kind of document it and also to help parents see, okay, this is what's going on. Because I don't want to, you know, there's always rare cases, like 1%, that might be a little different. But every parent, you know, thinks their kid, I would say that these wedding episodes present in a way that give you the concept that it's happening for different reasons. For example, they try to wake them up at night and they won't wake up. They go, oh, they're very deep sleepers. Or when they wet so much urine that just cooks the bed. They're like, well, they're making too much pee. And I get all that, but that has not been consistent in the literature. We can talk about why that those may be seen. But I've just seen too much for our protocol in terms of getting kids better. I've also seen I think it was a really good test of a theory. I've seen the opposite. I've seen kids get worse if you stretch the rectum out. Like, I can almost make a child wet the bed by filling their rectum, you know, with fluid, or, you know what I'm saying? So the model works both ways.
Yeah. So interesting. And yeah, that's crazy. That stat, you know, for only 5% of the patients that you're seeing, it's kind of obvious constipation. But it's so, I think, you know, bedwetting is such a common issue and it's so hard to get on top of. So this information for parents is, you know, super, super valuable. So can you talk about some of the challenges that are faced by, you know, parents and kids when it comes to bedwetting and accidents in their kids and how your work can help them overcome these challenges?
Yeah, so I want to be very sensitive to the fact that we can easily describe this model, right, and show you diagrams and papers and so forth, explain why it works. But then getting parents from that to dry is not so easy. And I don't want anyone to hear this and then say, well, there's the solution, give their child some Miralax or the Australian version, and get them pooping more, and then they don't get dry and give up on it because they lost faith in what's going on. And so I will say that I'm fully convinced that our model is valid. There's a lot of people out there that have different opinions, and I can back it up. But I've seen it happen. But at the end of the day, if you get an x-ray in a child and they've been holding their poop and you didn't even know it and their rectum is dilated, you have to get that shrunk back down to normal. And that may be harder than you think. Well, there's several pitfalls. Number one, reading the x-ray is not easy, and I don't know why, but if you get the x-ray, a radiologist may not think poop in the rectum is any different than poop in the ascending colon or transverse colon or descending colon. We're very particular how we read the x-ray. So if you get an x-ray, someone that knows what they're talking about needs to look at it to diagnose the dilation. And number two, you have to direct your therapy towards emptying out the rectum. I have a saying that child is not empty unless they're dry or you've looked and they're empty, because I can't tell you how many kids have come in. They said, we know we did 2 Miralax cleanouts. We took all this X-lax. He's got to be empty, but he's not dry. What gives? We get an x-ray and they're still very full. And I'm not trying to make it a cop out. It's the reality. It's not easy to take a very dilated colon and shrink it back down. And so we have a lot of protocols in our books that we can talk about that empty them out. But then there's other factors that involve, right? So the bladder is overactive from the dilation of the colon. But sure, drinking a lot of fluid before bed might make you more likely to wet the bed, or drinking really rapidly. So there's medicines you can add to it to augment the treatment. There's stuff we add to it because we realize it's not that easy to get the rectum cleaned out and fix the root cause. So there's ancillary therapies we can use to help these kids get drier faster. But we do believe fixing the root cause is better long-term for their general health.
Yeah. So, and what I'm hearing you say is like, it's not a quick fix, you know, it's not like, you know, taking laxatives for a week and then, you know, everything's going to be good. And yeah, that shrinking, you know, the rectum once it's been stretched, I think is a really important point. So I know like this is all lined out in your book, which we'll talk about in a second, but is there anything that parents can sort of, I guess, or should know about how to kind of get that that shrinking happening?
Yeah. So when we first started treating this, we treated it with osmotic laxatives, which are powders you drink, is it called Glycolax? I can't predict it right. I lose the terminology in different
countries. No, that's okay. We'll make sure that Australian versions of these medications are in the in the show notes.
So basically there's, you know, it's powder laxative that make the, that are osmotic agents that just draw water in the colon and make it easier to poop. So we were doing a lot of daily Miralax, and then we would do some clean out so often and get a lot of kids better, but not every kid responds to that. And so then the original creator of this kind of discovery of this cause of bedwetting was Dr. Sean O'Regan in the 80s. And he, a brilliant man, still alive, and I believe in Arizona. And he used enemas, which I would have never thought to use because when I first heard about it, I probably had the same reaction most of your listeners have, that who wants to use an enema. But then when I thought about it, I realized how brilliant it was because it's getting to the root cause of the problem. And so he would just do daily enemas. And it's an interesting story. He treated his son first because his son was wetting the bed. And when he diagnosed the cause, he treated it directly and made him better. And so we do use protocols with enemas as well in suppositories just to get the rectum emptied regularly. And we do them daily until the problem is resolved. And then we taper them off. And at this point, we've been doing this so long, we've tried everything. We've had some protocols with X-lax or Senna-based laxatives. We are agnostic to what people use to get empty, as long as they get empty and as long as it's safe. So some mom may come up with an even better protocol, but we just want to get the rectum empty as fast as possible. And I do struggle with, like, what is theoretically the fastest it can be done, right? Because I know it can be done overnight. Dr. O'Regan got most kids dry with only bedwetting in about a month. So it seems like a good guideline is 30 days of good emptying should help these kids, but not every kid responds in a month, but you know, it's a good guideline.
Yeah. And on the enemas, like, are you getting patients to do, like, parents to take care of doing that at home with their kids?
Yes. They're doing it before bed at home. Yeah. There's some store-bought ones they can use. You can make homemade enemas. There's lots of different ways we can do it. We have large volume, small volume, and we have your listeners will see in our website, we have several different books, several different protocols, and they're all different and they're all unique. And what I've struggled with is parents want to move up to, like, what's the biggest one? I want the best protocol, you know? Yeah. And what we found is they all have their role, but they all work differently. Different kids. One kid may get better with one kid may get better with the other. And it doesn't have a stepwise. They're more kind of like a choose your own adventure and see what works best for you, not really a stepwise approach.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, I guess, looking at the whole picture of the child's health as well in there, like in terms of what's going to work best for one kid compared to another.
What they can tolerate too. Not all kids can do all these protocols.
Yeah, I know. And I'm thinking of, like, the logistics of getting a child to agree to an enema as well. You know, some kids are going to be very anti that, aren't they? Do you have any, like, practical tips for that?
Yeah, we have actually a PDF handout. I'm sure it's on the website. Maybe we could get it to your listeners as a free download. But, you know, in reality, it's been easier than I thought. When I first heard, I was like, there's no way. You know, first of all, you know, I'm not a GI doctor, I'm a urologist. So I was like, is this safe? You know, and so I had to go do the research, talk to the doctors. We got all the safety issues handled. And then most kids are fine with it. You know, I'm not saying all of them are, but most kids do great. They feel better. They feel like they're getting empty. And honestly, getting the kids to do the enema is not the problem. It's getting them empty, even with enemas. See, some kids are so full. It's just, you need to throw kitchen sink at it. And again, I don't want parents to get discouraged. So we do have other stepwise, you know, we add medicines, we can do extreme measures to get kids dry if you have a short time frame. But if you have time and you can follow the progress, keep getting them empty, check regularly with x-rays, then we can definitely get them better.
Okay. And so, yeah, can you tell us more about you've got two books that are available in ebook format. And I think, are they available in hard copy as well?
Yeah, they should be. Yes, they definitely are.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. One of them's called the MOP Anthology. Have I got that right?
Yep, you're exactly right.
And one of them's called Bedwetting and Accidents Aren't Your Fault. So can you tell us more about those and what they offer to parents and children?
Yes, thank you. So the Bedwetting and Accidents Aren't Your Fault is our kind of children's book for kids and parents to get the message across to everyone that the child's not doing this volitionally, that it's a disturbance in the body because of withholding that led to these accidents, much like we talked about at the beginning, and kind of get that clear the air there with that topic. So no one's frustrated or upset or blaming anyone as we're trying to get empty. So that's our attempt to prevent the blaming and abuse of children for incontinence, which is definitely not their fault. And that's available in parent. That was something parents would read with their children. And then the MOP anthology is our most up-to-date version of the modified O'Regan protocol. So O'Regan, as you recall, was the guy that first invented the treatment, discovered this cause, the treatment. So that's the O'Regan protocol. It was a 3-month protocol of nightly enemas for a month and then a taper over 2 months. We rapidly, as we increased our number of patients, found that not everyone gets better in a month. And that's, we had to modify it. And that's why we called the modified O'Regan protocol. And that's basically a guide of all the protocols we've come up with. We've done some kind of clever naming. We have MOP-X, MOP Plus, JMOP for various reasons. People will find out as they read it. But it's basically just different ways to try to get the colon empty as fast as possible, and to have a lot of different options. Some kids want to do only enemas. Some kids want to do enemas and oral laxatives. Some kids' schedule doesn't allow that. And so we try to find different ways, and they're all interchangeable. We recommend you stick with one for at least 4 weeks and measure progress. And then you can either check an x-ray, or if you're getting better, continue it. But if you're not doing well, you can switch to a different protocol. And we don't like people to do any one protocol for too long if they're not getting better, because we don't like people to be spinning their wheels and get frustrated. So every 4 weeks, we like to reassess our progress. And that's what I do in my own clinic as well.
Yeah. And the MOP anthology book kind of, you know, walks people through that so they can, implement that themselves. And so just something else that you said, so it is really necessary to have those x-rays to be making sure that you're making progress. Is that correct? Is there any other way that we can kind of measure that?
Yes. So I would say that I get the x-rays to measure progress, but also to convince parents. So it serves the role of approving them, because I know a lot of your parents will say, you know, my child's not constipated. So it helps diagnose it, helps measure progress. But if they're not getting better, they probably still are full. So if you're trying to avoid the x-ray, you can just try tweaking without the x-ray. If they are getting better, then you don't need the x-ray, because you know you're getting better. And then ultrasound is another option if you're trying to avoid radiation or x-ray is not available. But it is very tricky. I've not found many people that can reliably do an ultrasound to measure the rectum. They'll often measure a segment, you know, at the very end or somewhere where you're not getting a maximal width measurement, whereas the rectum, you're seeing the whole kind of colon there, so you can find out where it's widest. So I don't want people to, I've seen someone come back with an ultrasound that was normal, convinced it wasn't the problem, and then later on realize that they were full. So I hate for that to happen. I'm not saying that every child in the world ever has had this backed up poop. There's a couple conditions that are very rare. It can cause incontinence that you know, your doctor should pick up on. But most kids do have this problem, so I wouldn't want to miss it if it was there.
Yeah, really good point. And I love that you said, you know, if you're getting better, then it's a pretty good sign that things are emptying and working. You probably don't need the x-ray. And again, if things are not changing and the wedding or pooping accidents are still there, then it's probably, you know, after that 4 weeks, a good time to move on to a different protocol.
Yeah, well, because I've made that mistake where I talked to families and they're like 6 months into it and they're like, we're still doing the same thing. I'm like, oh, geez. And I will note that, you know, as we mentioned, that a lot of kids, the accidents progress from daytime, probably bedwetting to day wetting to poop accidents. Not always, but that's a typical progression. They get better in reverse order. So poop accidents should get better pretty quickly. If you don't have poop accidents taken care of within a month, you know, we need to talk, because that should be fixed. Daytime wetting usually right after that. And then bedwetting is a little bit more difficult, but definitely fixable.
Yeah. Okay. That's really good to know. Oh, thank you so much. This has been such an interesting chat. Is there anything else you want to share with our audience before we finish up?
So there are traditional therapies for bedwetting, such as medications. Like most parents will get like a medicine from the doctor that limits the urine output at night, like desmopressin. There's bladder stabilizing medicines. We do offer those as well, but we offer them as a second step, because we found that kids that take the medicine when they're really full of poop, very rarely are effective, but there can be more effective as a second step once you're emptier, if you're not completely dry yet. And then we even have surgeries we do as a last resort for kids that really need to get dry. And that includes Botox and injections in the bladder, or a bladder pacemaker called the InterStim device. And these are just last ditch efforts. Maybe you have a kid that's 17 years old, getting ready for college, wants to be dry. You don't have time to get them empty. we have other things. So we can get every kid dry. It just takes, you know, time, and we can compress the time between levels if we're in a hurry.
Yeah. Okay. That's great to know. What about bedwetting, like alarms? What do you think of those?
Bedwetting alarms can be effective. It's kind of like a New Year's resolution or a treadmill people get. People like to get them, but then they rapidly stop using them because they're so difficult. No one likes waking up at night. So it's harmless, and it can help. But you know what's interesting is that there used to be a big push on, oh, these kids have sleep disorders, that's why they wet the bed. This is a very important point. If you really look at the research, what happens is that kids have bedwetting and therefore they sleep poorly. It's the other way around. And so if you don't fix the bedwetting and you just wake them up more at night, I really think it messes with their brain. I don't think they're getting good sleep. And I would rather focus on getting their problem fixed at the root cause level. And so they can have restful sleep earlier, better, you know, brain development and so on. So I don't like the idea of kind of taking a kid that's not sleeping well already and rattling them awake. But trust me, most parents give up on these alarms because the kids never wake up with them, and it's a struggle. But I would, if there's a family out there that would help, then, you know, I'm all for it, obviously.
Yeah. Like you said, harmless. But again, it's not getting to the root cause. You know, it's only
exactly,
going to
yeah.
get you so
it's a
far.
Burden. It's a burden. It's not fun for families, but.
No.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, thank you so much for coming on. We will make sure we pop the links to your websites and your books that are such a great resource for parents in the show notes. So make sure you come on over if you're a listener and, you know, check out Dr. Steve's websites and all the resources he has to offer. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. And we've talked to a lot of folks in Australia. We offer some remote consults. So if you're in a bind, you can always reach us on our website.
Oh, okay. Awesome. That's really great to know. I'll make sure that I pop, you know, the link to that in the show notes as well. Thanks so
sure.
much.
Thank you. Good day.
Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. Head on over to our website, naturalsuperkids.com, for the show notes for this episode, as well as a whole heap of inspiration to help you raise healthy and happy kids. I'll see you next week. Before you go, don't forget about my free online on-demand masterclass, 3 Simple Ways to Naturally Boost Your Kids' Immunity to Avoid a Winter Full of Sickness. I'm sharing my practical tips on ways that you can strengthen your whole family's immune system to avoid the onslaught of winter infections so your family can stay healthy and well this winter. You can sign up at naturalsuperkids.com/immune.